You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, The Brian Callen Show with my esteemed colleague in a lime green or a fuchsia green shirt.
I think it's key lime.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's key lime. A key lime pie shirt. Very Cuban of you. And wonderful khakis.
Mm.
I have a belly full of, this is when you know you've been living in LA too long, organic turmeric layered chicken fingers.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. I'm not done.
Go on.
Some quinoa tabbouleh.
Ooh.
Uh-huh.
That's an ancient grain, isn't it, Brian?
Do I eat any other grain?
No.
I mean, I can't believe I even eat grain. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, I stopped eating bread and my whole life opened up. And then I'm eating some 12-month-aged Manchego.
Mm.
People hate when you're chewing in the mic, so I'm not going to. I'm going to keep it under my tongue.
Mm. And I'm like gonna a lozenge.
I'm going to absorb all that sheep protein.
Oh, wow.
Into my mouth membrane. So attractive. Take a second to throw up, everybody.
This podcast is actually hugely popular with bulimics.
Oh my god.
They just listen to Brian describe his eating habits. Well, and you know,
I'm at this really fancy store, and they had pH balanced. Let me read that bottle. It says generosity alkaline water 10 pH.
Wow.
Reverse osmosis purified ionized for alkalinity. I should be punched in the face for even buying it.
Yeah,
but it looked refreshing as fuck because it was a see-through bottle with this beautiful blue wording on it. So when you do that, you go, I'm thirsty.
Yeah, and how did you react to the pH 10 thing?
Oh, well, my body is now is now balanced. The amount of money that has been made, the number of houses that have been bought over labeling waters and tonics and potions, pure balancing and detoxifying.
Well, think about soda, right? Soda is just a can of sugar water, right? Yeah. But they create an emotional experience. What's the difference between Royal Crown Cola or, you know, President's Choice Cola and Coca-Cola?
A lot, as in years of ingraining into my head.
That's right.
That things are good when I drink Coke, like it's America's soft drink.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of emotional associations that they've created so that they can sell you sugar water, and you will feel like, I must have that kind of sugar water rather than a different kind.
When I was growing up in Saudi Arabia, you can only get Pepsi. I don't know why. And my mother would always talk about real Coca-Cola and how she was dying for a real Coca-Cola. And back then it would come with in bottles, and she always talked about real Coca-Cola. She drank it. This is my mother, and she drank one, and I was watching her, and she went, this is not right. And I said, what? She goes, it's not right. First of all, we had to find the glass bottle.
Right.
And then she looked on the label, and she said, I knew it. And I said, what? She said, they're using corn syrup and not sugar.
Yeah.
Damn it. Mm-hmm. I can't get a real Coke anymore. And, well, anyway.
Well, that's Mexican Coke now.
Yes. I tried a Coke. I eat healthy, and I probably haven't had a Coke in I don't know how long. And it's not because I'm, but my buddy, who's a martial arts instructor and a health expert or whatever he is, but he's in great shape, and he poured this ice-cold Coke, and he drank some, and he said, dude, I want you to try this.
Mm-hmm.
I went, why? He goes, it's the best thing in the world.
Wow.
And I took a sip. And it was the best thing I've ever had in my life. So, yeah. Anyway, the bottom line is your RC Cola doesn't compare to my Coca-Cola.
Wow, Brian. See, and that's the thing. You endorse the product for free. Coca-Cola has
And I would never have them sponsor me.
That's right.
I don't drink their stuff. I had that thought. I've talked about this before, but I had that thought. If people came to me and said, we'll give you $2 million to sponsor Coca-Cola. I know I couldn't do it.
Yeah. But you just did it for free.
I did do it for free. Yeah, that's true. It was delicious. But I don't think there's anything wrong with drinking a Coke once in a while. I just don't want to do it because I don't drink it. So right. I'd be lying.
Well, but I think that's the thing. It's like all of these things in moderation.
Yeah, and we always forget that word, especially in California. Who was it we had on the podcast who said we live in the weirdest place in the world?
Was that Joe Henrich, maybe?
I think it was Joe Henrich.
Yeah, because the Western, educated, industrialized, I can't remember what the other one is, and democratic, right? But, yeah. But the weirds are this culture that, you know, have sort of risen to the fore.
Our American culture is always reinventing itself and always it's a form of chaos. It's a form of destruction and then rebuilding, right? I mean, think about Donald Trump, who I think is actually mentally ill, and Obama said something great. He goes, he doesn't know much, and he's also not interested in learning what he doesn't know.
No.
And I bet you he hasn't read... I was talking to my father about this. I bet you he hasn't read 5 books in his life. I don't know.
It's pretty clear that he doesn't read. And there was a good article that made the point that, you know, you don't have to be a big reader to be a great president necessarily.
No.
You know, Dwight Eisenhower used to read short executive summaries, right? But yeah. Dwight Eisenhower also won World War II.
Yeah.
So he clearly, there's a big difference between being a failed businessman and, you know, winning World War II. Right.
Yeah, and of course, he himself didn't win World War II.
No, not single-handedly.
But he was an effective general. He was actually very good at the nitty-gritty.
Yeah.
He was very good at doing the shitty jobs people didn't want
that's right.
to do. He was meticulous and always kept his emotions in check. Mm-hmm. And he had an affair with a woman, and the letter he wrote her, she was desperately in love. She was his assistant, and they were both in love, you know. And he decided it was going to be a bad thing to keep it going, and he sent her a short telegram saying... something to the effect of, my correspondence with you will now cease. I hope you will check in with me from time to time, as I will always be interested in how you are getting on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
But I think to segue off of the American culture always reinventing itself,
yeah.
that's really sort of gets the core of what mixed mental arts is about.
Yeah.
Because the you know...
Oh, I forgot to say, this is MMA for the mind.
Yeah.
Damn it.
But the, you know, I'm sure that everybody enjoyed your thoughts on the beverage industry.
Thank you. God, what a bunch of drivel. Yeah.
But
back to substance.
Yeah, but so there's you know, two sort of dominant ways of talking about culture right now, right, which is the software that your brain runs.
Mm-hmm.
And the first way of talking about it is, you know, my culture is better than your culture, la, 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 you should all be like me, right? The other way is sort of the liberal way, which is like... you know, there's all this painful trauma of, you know, past cultural imperialism and, you know, the Holocaust. And so they just don't want to talk about culture at all or pretend that culture matters. Let's focus on institution. Let's spend a bunch of money. That's how we're going to solve things like education and health and, you know, develop poor countries.
Well, then by the way, I'd add to that, the biggest taboo, in fact, is to talk about cultural deficits.
Yeah.
If you were to say that your culture mm-hmm. is part of the reason or all of the reason you're not doing well socioeconomically.
And that's what we're going to say on the Brian Callen show.
Yeah, I mean,
so.
Those are very, very dicey, sticky subjects. Your culture may work or have worked over here,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't work for this ever-changing world, or it just doesn't work, period.
And that's the whole point of mixed mental arts.
Yeah.
And so that's why we're going to be talking about culture in a third way, mm-hmm. right? And that third way is the way that the Japanese thought of culture in the Meiji Restoration.
Jesus.
So this is, you know, it's a whole third way. It's
you guys
very
hear
exciting.
That? The Japanese and the Meiji Restoration.
That's right, because we study with Master Kim.
That would be Korean.
Korean, but, and they don't have the best relationship.
I was
going to
say, never confused.
But
yeah, Meiji. That's just how a samurai would say it.
But that's so you know. This is we can have maybe you know a character called Meiji who is our samurai warrior,
oh.
and he's going to cut through culture and show us what's on the inside.
Do you ever notice how they stop short of? They're so precise, Meiji.
Well, there's always Meiji. Like. That's sort of more Yakuza, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're like, Hontoni!
Yeah, it's intense. yeah.
It's very intense. But then there's, like, Japanese schoolgirl, which is more like, Hontoni! Nihongo ga dekimasu ka? right? And that's sort of like much more fluid. But they have very strong differences.
Two extremes.
Yeah, two extremes. Two extremes.
Yeah.
So in the Meiji Restoration, so for 200 years under the Tokugawa shogunate, the Japanese shut themselves off from the world. They were total isolationists.
Yes. Yep.
And they had this one island, Dejima, near Nagasaki, where pretty much only the Dutch and the Chinese and to some extent the Portuguese could trade,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But they were all isolated to this one island. And
yes.
over those two...
Was this when Shogun was supposed to take place? Was that the time? Yeah. Because I remember James Clavell, I mean, his character was, I think, a Dutch or a Portuguese tradesman.
Yeah.
And the way the Japanese looked at how dirty they were.
Oh, they didn't like them at all.
And they were hairy.
Yeah.
And they were horrifying.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And there's also, there's strong associations, like the whole hairy thing. So there's an indigenous group of people in the north, the Ainu.
Ainu.
And they're very hairy as well.
They look very Aryan.
Well, they probably
look, they
are.
They look white. I mean,
yeah.
Don't they? They look...
There's some sort of mixture in there.
Yeah, they look Afghani or something.
Yeah.
They don't look Chinese. Those are the indigenous people. Too.
That's right. But so there's a whole bunch of cultural associations in Japan with, you know, hairiness and all of that sort of
stuff.
And
primitive.
Yeah, and big noses. Like when you go to Japan, they focus on how big our noses are.
Yeah.
You know. They're
incredibly racist.
And, they are.
And a lot of the Meiji Restoration isolationism has carried over.
Racy.
I think they've accepted exactly zero Syrian refugees. And they could use immigration.
Yeah, it's a huge...
The Japanese have serious problems with sustaining their population.
Because
they're all old.
Yeah. And they don't even though the Koreans, you know, to us, like the sort of the visible differences between a Korean and a Japanese person aren't so obvious, but like, you know, Koreans don't get to blend very well into Japanese
society.
They're
treated like secondhand citizens. In fact,
yeah.
a lot of people don't know is a lot of the Yakuza are ethnically Korean.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
They are ethnically Korean.
Yeah.
So a lot of the badass Yakuza are actually not ethnically Japanese.
Uh-huh.
They were essentially couldn't find jobs. They were second class citizens and they got into crime. So.
Well, when you don't allow people to integrate into society, like Freeway Rick Ross, they tend to occupy the niche of crime, extra legal activities.
And cream.
Oh, yeah. They're huge in the dairy industry.
Yeah. Cream.
Brian, why are you so into cheese?
Cream is an acronym, you fucks.
But no one knows what it's an acronym for.
That's true.
Keep
that to ourselves. Anyway, keep going.
So they shut themselves off for 200 years, and then Commodore Perry, who's a U.S. Navy guy, sails into Tokyo Harbor with these big black ships, they're steamships, and have these massive cannons. And so the Japanese basically are like, holy shit. Like, we've locked ourselves off from the world for 200 years. Clearly, the world has moved
this
on.
This has become a stale pond,
an incestuous
world of ideas that haven't really moved.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, look at the military power these guys have. If we don't catch up...
We're going to be squashed.
Exactly. We're going to be the world's bitches. And so, rather than do that, what they did was they sent out experts to Europe, America, and they looked at all the different systems of, you know, government, the legal system, educational system, military organizations. And they copied the best parts of each. During the Meiji Restoration, what they did was they didn't stop being Japanese, but they swapped out the engine, right?
Mm.
And that is how, you know, human progress often works. So, you know, Super Freakonomics has done a good job of popularizing the story about how, you know, there was a huge problem with pollution, right?
Yeah.
Back during the days of the horse-drawn carriage, and that was horse shit.
Yeah.
Streets were covered in horseshit. And so then the car comes along, and suddenly it's like, what a pollution-saving device.
Yeah.
It just pumps out these harmless gases.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when you get enough of these harmless gases, that becomes an issue too.
Yeah.
But if you look at the old horse-drawn carriages and you look at the first cars, they look basically the same.
Yeah, they do.
You've just swapped out the form of locomotion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially what the Japanese did with their culture. They swapped out the driving forces. So they moved from being a feudal culture to being an industrial culture.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we've moved into another environment, which is the information age culture. And so there are a whole bunch of intuitions and behaviors that, you know, you and I need in order to thrive in this environment. So, for example, we have to have a very different relationship to knowledge, where, you know, when we make mistakes, we embrace them, and we analyze them, and we use them to get better.
Well, that's a rare...
That is a rare thing. But yeah. Look at Silicon Valley. That's sort of the core value of Silicon Valley is failing fast and failing forward and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And the strange thing, you know, for Katie O'Brien and I, is that then when you have people like Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates and they want to reform education, they're not trying to copy that core value of their culture. What they're trying to do is, oh, we're going to give you resources and we're going to give you iPads and all that sort of stuff. But that's not why they succeed.
Well, you know, I talked to an educator who, a child development psychologist, and she said, rich people give money to these kids. What kids need is your time.
Yeah.
They need interaction. And you said, you know, but we'll keep going with what you're saying. But that's...
But they also...
That's why, like I said, what, do you think that's a good school? And you said, anybody who relies on a school to educate their kids is a fool. That's not how you educate your kids. It's what you supplement with example and all that stuff. Yeah.
It's the same. It's, you know, the point is that even, you know, training in MMA, there's a certain amount of gym time, but also so much of it is what is the attitude you bring to the gym?
Oh yeah.
Right. And so you can take,
and to the octagon, I mean, to the actual ring,
it's 100%.
Very, very different. It's a very different pace. It's a very different everything.
And that's going to determine how much value you extract from that gym time and how well you do in the octagon.
Yeah.
So, you know, the parents have to get that basic culture and those basic intuitions and assumptions right about, for example, mistakes or looking up things you don't know or using checklists. It's a certain humility, which is to say also, I mean, that's a huge thing, right? You know, people, if what happens to a fighter who goes into a gym and is like, I know it all already, how does he do?
Not well.
And in the same
thing.
Well,
and I would also add that the MMA is a really good metaphor because in the UFC, if you take a year off, the game is evolving so quickly.
Yep.
And the other thing is you have a team of guys that are watching all the things you do well, and then they're planning for that. So if you don't come to the game with new tricks, good luck. Mm-hmm. Boxers, I just talked to Andre Berto, who's a great fighter, fought Mayweather, and he was saying the same thing. The guys you meet up with have fought you before in the amateurs. They got guys who know what your tendencies are, and you better always be changing. That's part of the reason I love things like fighting and MMA. And I think that if you want to compete in the 21st century, you've got to think of yourself as the idea that you're a fixed entity, or that your ideas that have been given to you, there are principles that are important, right?
Yeah.
There are ideas, you know, your ethical and moral framework is very important.
Yeah, but even that, it's not so much that it needs to change, but it needs to be reexamined.
I had to. I remember when having arguments with a woman when I was 21 about, I was like, I don't think gay men should raise a kid. What? Two men? What are you talking about? That'll screw the kid up. Mm-hmm. And this woman had been raised by gay parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that was so antithetical to how I was raised.
Yeah.
It's not, my parents aren't prejudiced at all, but everybody was like, what? Two dads? What? It's not natural. And you hear all those things.
Right.
And by the way, that's immoral, it's unethical. You could use all those words, but you're right. That's a good example of where I think we've kind of said, hold on. We've been given a certain moral and ethical framework, but is it inclusive? Is it really inclusive?
Well,
is it really good for children who don't have parents?
It's also that, you know, humans are bad at figuring out what matters and what doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, if you see a bunch of immigrants coming in, right, and, you know, they're all wearing the hijab and they worship Allah and all that sort of stuff, it's easy to think, you know, these people are different, and, you know, you tend to focus on the dress and the sort of the visible superficial parts of the culture that don't fit, right, and say that's a problem.
Yeah.
In fact, there are things that are a problem within their culture. For example, if you remember Tamim Ansari.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, corruption is a huge, huge problem in, you know, most of the world.
Yeah.
But it fundamentally comes down to having more loyalty to your family than to a notion of fairness.
Yes.
Right?
That's another way of saying people are tribal.
That's right.
You know, when tribalism, and that's a problem in Africa, that's a problem in the Arab world. Tribal societies, those are hard things, Somalia, those are hard things to break.
Right. And if you're coming into the environment of the United States, you have to change those values in order to thrive. And also the United States should defend those values because they are the basis of a meritocratic, democratic, competitive society.
You know, but then the meritocratic, democratic societies, I think, are actually, they make sense to everybody in a lot of ways. When people come to this country, those ideas, that the person who put out the most effort, the person that's actually better,
but you have
should get the job.
See, that's the problem, is people's intuitions only change if they reflect on them and they examine them.
Well, yes, but I wonder if... See, I think that is a human intuition. I think ultimately...
But it's not.
I think that they... I think the easiest thing to change is something like that, because it's so apparent. So if somebody's just a better violinist by far than you, you're going to concede defeat for the most part. You're going to know, and if you don't, you're going to have to invent reasons why.
But see, therein is the issue. The human capacity to invent reasons why, right?
Doesn't last, though.
Oh, it doesn't last if you're surrounded by people who think differently and who hold you accountable.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about slavery. I mean, in this country at least, slavery, you know, the moral justification for slavery, people kept trying to come up with fancy ways to justify it morally. They were using the Bible, and they were, well, it's always happened, a thousand things. And the lesser of two evils and all that stuff. And I feel the same way about any fundamentalist belief, Islamic fundamentalism, this obsession with purity and this obsession with literal truth and all that. Those things, they do have a shelf life. I don't think they last. So when Francis Fukuyama writes The End of Man...
The End of History.
The End of History, I think what he's saying is that we've come to a point where democracy, where personal freedom, where we value personal freedom and personal expression, and also value property rights and keeping your promises and institutions that enforce those kinds of things. Liberal democracy. That is a very hard thing to go back from.
Well,
in other words, you know the truth. When you see it, you know it's the truth.
You know the truth. But the whole point of what's happening in this election.
Yeah.
So let me tell you about my Uncle Bill. Okay,
yeah.
My Uncle Bill is from Kansas City.
Yep.
And I love my Uncle Bill dearly.
Yep.
And he works for Ford at the Ford plant as an electrician.
Yep.
And he's responsible for me getting my car. And it's a great car, and he's awesome, right? But, you know, Uncle Bill does not like Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And he does not in general like the Democrats and all this sort of stuff.
Sure.
So, and I totally understand that. You know, we had Larry Lessig on. Hillary Clinton is pretty much the poster child for campaign finance, you know, abuses and all this sort of stuff, right? She very much benefits from that system, which is a corrupt system and I think is antithetical to what democracy in the United States are about, right? Mm-hmm. But
people would argue that, by the way, but go on.
Of course, people will argue.
Giving money to a candidate is part of free speech.
Yeah,
at least according to Michael Malice.
But that's the whole point, Brian, is that, you know, you say that people know the truth in the end of history and The Last Man, but something like campaign finance, some people think it is on the side of freedom, and some people think it's against freedom.
Yeah.
So we don't know the truth. There isn't clarity. Otherwise, if there was clarity...
But you just used the word twice. There is a constant there, and that is they're arguing over what freedom is.
But
freedom is the ideal.
Oh, but see, Brian, that's the whole point. So now we have to go back to Jonathan Haidt and moral intuitions, mm-hmm. right? So we all have these moral intuitions of freedom, loyalty, care, authority, all these sorts of things, sacredness, you know, and he outlines six, right? But then we hook up what we care about to those, so pro-choice, pro-life. Everybody has those notions of choice and freedom, right? And for, you know, people who believe that a woman should be able to have an abortion.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So even an Islamic fundamentalist is working for a kind of freedom.
Well, or they might not use freedom in that case.
Yeah, that's right.
In that case, they might use sacredness, or they might use...
Morality.
They'll use some sort of morality.
Sacredness, yeah.
But so what Haidt is saying is that everybody comes pre-equipped with these six basic intuitions, and he's made it clear it may not just be six, there may be others, right? But there's at least six, mm-hmm. and then we hook up the causes that we care about to them. So, you know, is there a clear, definitive answer on pro-choice versus pro-life? No. Why does the argument not move forward? Why do we not sort of, like, try and figure out what the best sort of solution is? Because we're so busy viewing this as a moral issue and having it hooked up to choice versus life.
Mm-hmm.
You can't solve that. What's more important, liberty or life? Well, that's an argument that's been going on for 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So It's the same thing with corruption, right? You know, if you know, like Tamim Ansari said, in Afghanistan, if you get into power and you don't use that power to help out your friends and family, he said, you know, what kind of asshole would get into power and not help their family?
That's right.
They think in a totally different way than we do. Whereas, you know, we think that the point is that, oh, if I want the system to work, it needs to be fair and I need to find the best person for the job. So you have these intuitions, which are very Western intuitions.
Yeah.
And when you have immigrants who come into the country, they don't bring those intuitions with them. They can learn those intuitions. They can come to understand, oh, it made sense in an environment where everybody is sort of just helping out their family to do that. But part of the basis of success of the United States is that we do have a commitment to fairness and meritocracy.
But I would suggest that the world in one way or another seems to be moving in that direction overall.
Well,
I mean, you have a hard time arguing with anybody who's really even from Latin America, in my opinion. By the way, I bet you a lot of young Russian and Chinese people would feel the same way.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, this gets back to the Uncle Bill thing, right?
So, well, it gets back actually, in fact, I think, to whether or not people perceive an existential threat or not. I live in a very safe world. I live in the chances of me getting killed by a thug or by a gang or by a group of government toughs is pretty minimal comparatively, especially from a historical perspective. That allows me to do a lot of things. One is relax and think.
Mm-hmm.
Two is put effort into something because I know in 20 years it'll pay off dividends. I can spend a lot of money on a house, and I know ultimately I'll pay it off, and it'll be good for my children.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kinds of things I can do. And also, you know, really, I can get behind these ideals in such a strong way because they do seem to make the world more that way, much safer, right? When you treat everyone, regardless of color or creed, as an equal.
But it's important for you to understand, Brian, that you are weird, right? You are Western, you are educated, industrialized. You and I also have an unusual experience having lived all over the world, right? So we understand these things a lot more clearly than maybe some people do because we've actually had to think about these. So we're not relying on whatever intuitions we've picked up.
That's true.
Right? And the point is that the part of like why Joe Henrich is so important is because the culture that makes all of these things possible is not something that was invented in the last few hundred years. It is something that has evolved and developed over 10,000 years. So it is a very complex machine that deserves respect. And the problem is that there are people who do not understand it on both sides of the political aisle.
I wonder if that's so. I wonder if, in fact, the reason, like, so if you were to take villages of 150 or less,
yeah,
things, and you know, with hunter-gatherers for sure, things tend to be fairly egalitarian.
Yeah.
The set point, the default is to be somewhat egalitarian.
No, to be incredibly egalitarian.
Yeah. But what happens if you don't have strong institution in place is, and of course you can go and you can get into philosophy, you can get into Socrates and Aristotle and all this, and the religious philosophies and all that shit. But what happens, I think, if you don't have the proper incentive structure and deterrence in place, is that you get you get a charismatic sociopath.
Yeah, and there are a lot of those right now.
Like Donald Trump
and Erdogan and Orban and so many of these charismatic sociopaths
take everything over from there and
that's
and
right.
screw everything up. And they, you know, they mobilize armies behind propaganda and symbols and a beautiful country and all that shit. And law and order.
That's right.
And stuff like that. But I think that one of the good things about the United States is somehow we have been able to check and balance those kinds of demagogues.
But that's, you know, there's...
I don't even know if I made a point there, but what I was trying
to
say
is...
Well, no,
but see, here's the fallacy that I think you're buying into.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, Andrew Carnegie always said that in America, it's three generations from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, people who inherit things are not good at maintaining them.
That's right.
Because they don't understand them, they didn't have to build them from scratch, and so therefore, they have a tendency to screw them up. Mm-hmm. We have inherited American democracy. And there is a tremendous complacency around that.
That's very
true. It's worked for our entire lives. It worked for generations before that. And so we assume that it will always be here and it will always last.
That's a good point.
And every empire, every business empire, every company.
Look at Apple.
Yeah.
Dismal returns this quarter.
That's right. They've always assumed that whatever it is because we are special and it will last forever.
That's right.
And the problem is that very fundamental pieces of the American, you know, secret sauce have been undermined. For example, you know, you and I have the luxury of reading books. Yes, that's true. But we also have the inclination to read books. The mm-hmm. whole reason why this podcast started 200 episodes ago was because you and I were weird. We read all these books. We tried to understand them. We tried to figure them out. And we had literally nobody else to talk with about these things because most people don't read these books and don't try and figure these things out.
That's right.
The foundation of the First Amendment is not something that is written down. It is the culture of 1776, which, you know, again, David McCulloch talks about this in 76. They lived in a time when they believed that a man could teach himself whatever was required with a book. And so these people read voraciously all the time. They had a startup culture, right? They were trying to make the world's first stable and successful democracy.
They did, and they solved the political problem. That's right. It was a startup problem. It's like Ben Franklin said. The woman said, "What did you do in there? We created a republic, madam. If you can keep
it." But that's the point. If you can keep it, and there's a big difference between the culture of a startup and a very well established business.
Agreed.
And so, what are the problems of a well established business? What are the problems culturally?
Bureaucracy, sluggishness, hierarchy, inefficiency,
compartmentalization, complacency, arrogance, a focus on infighting rather than on making the enterprise as a whole outcompete other versions. So the point is that that's America today.
And ultimately, the product sucks.
Yeah, and that's America today. The point is that we're a late-stage company, and so you've got two choices, right? Either you let the company fail, which at this level of complexity would be a disaster, right? Just think about living in a city. Where is your nearest food supply? How long can you live in this city before you die? If there's no access to fuel, if today you I once sat next on a plane to a guy who works in shipping and logistics, right? And I was like, you know, if I pressed a button and I just stopped international trade, how long before we all die? And he's like, well, how long can a person live without food and water?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we all live, what we don't realize is that within a city, you live within, you know, a month or two of death at all times.
It's so funny because I was driving by Home Depot, I swear to God, and I said, well, I should really get some containers to store water.
Yeah.
But how long would that last?
But that's the point. You know, and that's the whole bug out end of the world prepper thing.
Yeah.
It's like, why not devote some of that energy and time to actually keeping the system alive and making it healthier?
Yeah. I think that we do. I think most people, that's not lost on
you
most
keep on,
people.
Brian, you have this, again, you have an emotional intuition that we're okay. And what I'm telling you is that that's dangerous.
I don't think that we're okay. I don't think complacency is helpful. And I do think democracy has to always, you have to be vigilant. And I do think we're always in danger of losing our democracy
and how
increments. It's an incremental thing.
How vigilant do you think people are today?
I think if you're talking about the Bush phenomenon, I mean the Trump phenomenon.
And the Clinton phenomenon. Because the point is that what we've developed...
Well, Clinton's a little bit different in that Clinton feels to people like Obama light or Obama heavy. In other words, Clinton represents, I think to most voters, business as usual, a sensible government insider who has lots of problems. Trump, on the other hand...
But the point is my Uncle Bill would say the opposite. But the point is that, you know, what you have in both cases is two echo chambers, mm-hmm. right? You know, North Korea, how does Kim Jong-un maintain control over North Korea?
Fear,
and he isolates them from information. Mm-hmm. They don't know what the outside world is like. You don't have to live in North Korea to be isolated from other thoughts. You can just be a diehard Democrat or a diehard Republican.
Yes.
And you will exist in a diehard anarcho-capitalist or whatever your diehard fanaticism is or an Islamic fundamentalist. And you live in this little echo chamber and everything internally makes sense. But that doesn't mean that your belief system fits reality and is accountable to reality. You have to, if you really want to like help this country or any country, what you have to do is you have to approach it like a startup. Mm. You have to constantly constantly have the fear, the recognition that you're trying to outcompete much more powerful forces.
But see, I think a lot of people feel the same way you do.
Name me a person.
Well, the this election and the anger around Trump and even around Hillary Clinton and this contentious debate and this nasty debate is part of, I think, that you do have people saying something's wrong. My guy's going to take care of it. Something's wrong. I'm with her.
Something's wrong. My guy's going to take care of it.
Yeah.
So the way I respond to thinking that something is wrong is not re-questioning my own assumptions, being like, huh, something must be off with the Democratic worldview or something must be off with the Republican worldview.
No, I think people are asking that.
I have played this experiment on Facebook, right? I have tried to float up bubbles of bipartisan reason.
You might be running into people who just don't know what to do.
No, Brian.
There's an ignorance, maybe.
There's a huge ignorance.
Because it's a huge... See, when the problem seems giant like this,
you
feel like a little, like a puppet, like a plaything.
That's
right. Like a listless, sort of powerless plaything.
Yeah.
Right? That's very common. And when World War II was happening...
So how are you feeling right now, Brian? When I'm trying to tell you that there's a problem and something fundamentally needs to change, and you keep on saying, oh, people are doing this, it's all going to be okay. What is that emotion?
I never said it was going to be okay.
Well, okay, fine, but
what I'm saying is that I don't think it's lost on people that there's something wrong. I think that this country always went through periods like this. There's a tendency to say, well, it's worse than it ever has been. I don't know.
But see, Brian, again, like, let's look at the arc of startup. Here's a question for you. If I suddenly said, okay, Brian Callen, like, we're gonna start a whole new country, right? We're gonna start America over. We take you back to 1776. It's your responsibility to start America. Can you do it from scratch?
If I had to be, I would just pick up the Constitution and say, follow this.
Exactly. But so there's a very big difference between, you know, saying, we do this. And that's the problem. Everybody's waving around the Constitution that's, we do this. But they don't fundamentally understand how to construct it, right? There's a big difference between being able to build a car and being able to be like, let's use the car.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the problem is that who today knows how to build the car?
Well, first of all, I think it's a collective effort.
Sure.
I also think that it's no one's job to know how to build a car.
One's job, then no one has the job, right? And then that means that you have a huge problem, right? There's a gap in personal responsibility there.
Well, no, but I think if you're, for example, if you're the president and your administration, there are constantly fires to put out.
Yeah,
you've got to
put
the fires out from the previous administration.
Yeah.
You've got to do damage control. You've got to decide whether or not you want to get involved or not involved.
So do you think, then that's fine. So great, but that's not the same thing as having clarity of understanding, right? So the point is, do you think that, you know, do you think that either...
But see, you get clarity of understanding, not... See, clarity of understanding is a very, very tricky...
Is it?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. Because clarity of understanding in a... Let's just take the American economy and what's good for it. Or let's just take the American political system and what's good for it. If you start talking about clarity of understanding, you can get into a major, not only debate, but a maze. There are so many things to think about. So when you talk about clarity of understanding, what you're actually talking about is principles and philosophy.
No, see, what you're doing right now is you're doing what has become the great cop-out among intellectuals, which is to say it's complex, which is the same thing as saying that I give you no answer.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that there are two things. There are two general schools of thought that I know of. One is let's get in there and engineer things to be more fair, and the other is let's not get involved and let this giant organism with so many different players play out. So here's my philosophy. Here's how I think you make it or keep it better. You ready?
Yeah.
I say this. I say I believe essentially in the free market, but let me put some caveats on that.
Right.
The free market works as long as you have a way to get people to keep their promises.
Yeah, I know. I've heard this spiel before.
And if they don't, you have to be able to punish them.
Right. For, and I'm going right? to and I'm going to tell you that's vague. And that's a spiel you learned.
You have
from,
to be vague.
No,
the founding
you don't
fathers
have
were
to be vague.
Vague. The
no,
founding
you don't
fathers.
Have to be vague.
Let me give you an example of how vague the founding fathers were. Let me give you an example of how incredibly vague the founding fathers were.
Okay.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Is there anything more vague than that?
No.
Life, you're entitled to three things.
Let me ask you
life,
this,
liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the rest is up to you as an individual.
So let me ask you this, Brian. In 1700, right, how clear was their understanding of tuberculosis?
Not very.
They didn't know about germs, they didn't know about bacteria, they didn't know anything. How clear is our understanding of tuberculosis now?
A lot better.
Right, we could say there's a bacteria. Yep. It's called Mycobacterium tuberculosis.
Sure.
And then we can test it for resistance and we can figure out what sort of antibiotics you need to treat it.
Sure.
See, that's specific. And that's what clarity does. Clarity about how the world works allows you to be effective. Mm-hmm. Do engineers have a vague understanding of how bridges work or how strong a particular material is and how much weight it can handle?
Well, hold on.
No, answer that question.
Yes, they do.
They do. They have clarity.
But that's a terrible example.
Why?
Because you're being a reductionist.
No, but see, Brian.
You are. You can't compare a bridge and the engineering of others to this massive political economic organism called the United States. And how do you solve the political problem? I would submit to you, sir, that the founding fathers in 1780 whatever were the ones that did it with the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Federalist Papers.
So here's the amazing thing: I can do those things because I understand the Meiji Restoration approach to culture, where I can go through trait by trait by trait by trait on the culture and figure out how to fix each one.
Oh, you're sounding like a philosopher king. And not only are you sounding like a philosopher king, my friend, you'd have a lot of arguments. For example,
you've accused me of being sounding like a philosopher king, which the implication there is that I think I know better than everybody else and I know what they should do. The point is that I can't make everybody do all these things, right? People are independent. They have their own choices. Yeah. They have things they want to do. I can't make everybody wash their hands after they go to the toilet, right? But is society better if we all wash our hands after we go to the toilet?
Well, probably.
Yes, probably more.
Or we build better immunity. But yeah,
Whatever, right? But there, is society better if we refrigerate our meat rather than leaving it out on the curb? Yes, 100%.
Uh-huh.
So the point is that I can't force anybody.
Or is society better for vaccine when we have vaccines?
There are all sorts of there are behaviors that make our society better.
Those are measurable goods,
100%.
Right? Yeah.
And these are not things that I can enforce.
But hold on. Yeah.
But I can speak to people. I can explain to them clearly and I can let them see what their self-interest is and then they can choose to do those things. Like, for example, analyzing mistakes in school. If every single person, every single child, and if this became a standard workplace practice, when something didn't work, when you got a bad test grade, you got it out, rather than wadding them up and throwing them away, which is a shame-driven behavior, you got it out and you figured out, why did number three go wrong? We do exactly what the FAA does. We do what Silicon Valley does. We know that behavior works. And if we fix that trait across all cultures, right, how much better would the world be?
That is what schools try to do.
No, they don't try to do because they don't deal with emotions. And that's why, why is it that Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg have a culture that is obsessed with embracing and analyzing mistakes, but then when they go out and they talk to students, they're like, have a freaking iPad. It's because they don't understand emotions and because they don't have clarity on how those behaviors are driven. Because they're still grounded in Descartes' error, which is that thinking and feeling are separate. So the point is that Bill Gates does not have clarity on how education works on a neurological level because like Sam Harris, or countless of these other people, these ideas have not diffused within science and they haven't diffused out to the public.
You can make the same argument with nutrition. People are counting calories instead of the kind of calories and stuff like that.
Yeah, but I'm talking about...
Sure. But you can borrow from culture, and yes, there are answers. See, so you can... The more you learn, closer you come to solving certain problems as they occur today, okay?
Okay.
But let me give an example. Campaign finance reform. I know how you feel about that. You feel strongly. You know that if you came at a lot of conservative philosophers, you'd have an argument on your hands.
100%.
Yes. And by the way, you probably would end up, both of you guys, or if you were both policymakers, not much would happen or something would happen and then it would be repealed.
But see, but hold on, Brian. That's the whole point, right? Yeah. So in the same way that before germ theory, there were a whole bunch of competing different theories, right? And for the sake of argument, let's imagine that I'm betting on the bad one, right? Let's imagine that, you know, my view on campaign finance is wrong. Right?
Yeah.
And then I believe in miasmatic theory. And then I go and I talk to these people who believe in germ theory, like Jon Snow, and I say, you know, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. But the key is how we disagree. Do I disagree? Hold on.
Not only that. Yes, the key is also, see, for example, like with our Constitution.
Yeah.
You're never really going to hear a lot of people say, our Constitution sucks, or, see, the Constitution
Is a sacred
is
document.
Is germ theory.
It's sacred.
It's germ. I mean, so we know, we all, it's a sacred document because it has worked.
Yes.
Okay.
But the point
now
is...
Now the rest is, how do you interpret it?
Yeah, but part of it is, you know, the first commandment, right, in becoming wise is that you have to know yourself, right?
Yeah.
It's you before you can even...
Or just coming to terms with your own limitations and learning what to do with them.
That's right. But you have to have a realistic view of how your mind works.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, from having talked to all these people, like, you know, I went to the fanciest schools in the world, and I never developed a decent knowledge of how my own mind worked. I only had to learn that from reading people like John Haidt and Daniel Kahneman and, you know, Antonio Damasio.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you think it would have changed if you'd been raised religious?
Well, it depends.
Because that's fairly intuitive, isn't it?
What do you mean?
Well, you know, Sam Harris is working on a very rational model of the brain. But Sam Harris is also a radical atheist. I wonder...
No, those two go together.
I wonder, though, if your education, your rational education, would have been different, and if you would have been making this claim if you had been raised with the idea that there was a God and with all the Christian, just for sake of argument, Christian attachments therein.
But see, I'm an apostate, Brian.
Jesus.
I'm a heretic,
Jesus.
Right? So, you know, I, like you, grew up in many cultures.
Destroyer!
Yeah, I grew up in many cultures, and you move across all of these different cultures, and then you start to realize what's wrong with each one,
yeah.
Right? And so I have gone through a state of apostasy, right, where I have left the culture of science, you know, as it currently stands. I believe in the scientific principle, right, which is, you know, like believing in the golden rule or anything like that. But the culture of science as it stands today is so deeply flawed that I don't think that, you know, I can really align myself with it.
You think the culture of science is flawed?
Yeah.
Because I would say that we're making exponential gains in science, aren't we? Because aren't we sharing ideas? Aren't we doing exactly what Joseph Heinrich talks about when you have scientists in India Skyping with scientists in Norway, etc.?
But the point is that the ideas about how scientists think and about how humans think are not diffusing within science. Because ultimately, what Joe Heinrich talks about, right, it's not just about sharing ideas, it's about the way in which we approach ideas in terms of the emotional content that exists between us, where there is it's not about me being right, it's about us trying to figure out the best solution. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that is not the culture of science. The culture of science is fundamentally today, it's about petty fiefdoms, my
well,
I wish we
approached all problems that way.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, gun control. Well,
100%.
All right, but what you really want to do, the problem you want to stop is mass murderers.
100%. Yeah. And Brian, if today we could flip the switch, right, and everybody was like, just approach the problems of the world with like, I don't know, but what I'm interested in is finding the best solution, and there are going to be compromises, but if we talk it through and figure it out, we can figure out what are the reasonable compromises.
Well, that would be nice instead of people saying, my philosophy is take everybody's gun away because
that's
I
right.
believe in central authority, and another guy goes, fuck you.
Yeah.
I believe in being able to shoot straight.
That's right. So the point is that that's those two echo chambers.
Yeah.
And so the intellectual culture that exists in the startup version of the United States in 1776 is like, damn, this problem is hard. Nobody has ever built a stable democracy, right? We can't totally, obviously people, there were camps and there was partisanship and people had agendas. But to some extent, right, they needed to broker a coalition,
yeah.
right? If you don't figure out some sort of agreement between those 13 states, you don't have a United States. Now it's too easy for red and blue to go onto opposite sides of the aisle and just claim that the other side is responsible for all of their woes.
Right.
So you've got a very, very different culture today from the one that you had in 1776. Right. Again, also, the like voting is the most visible part of democracy. That's the superficial part. But there's also the part where between elections, you're all supposed to be reading these books and desperately trying to figure out what's wrong with my thinking, what's missing, what do I not get? Rather than trying to confirm what you believe, you're trying to find holes in what you believe, which is what MMA is about, right? You know, a shitty MMA fighter goes out and is like, I'm good at this thing, so I'm just going to practice this thing I'm already good at. Mm-hmm. A good MMA fighter is trying to find holes in their game.
Right.
And that is not how most people approach ideas or understanding democracy today. They're not trying to find holes in their game.
So give us an idea, in closing, because this is very good, give us an idea of how one does that. How do you do that? How do you... You know, we all walk around with our philosophy, like I do.
Mm-hmm.
How do you ask yourself that question?
It's really simple. You listen to what your enemy says about your thinking.
Jesus!
Right? Because, and this is you know, this is a very Christian idea. Jesus always said, right, do not take the splinter out of your brother's eye, take the log out of your own.
Right.
And we're incredibly good at seeing each other's failings. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do is that, you know, there's two ways.
Yes, we are, by the way. That's why you can direct an actor.
That's right.
They can't direct themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, it's also like sometimes.
I don't need a director, by the way.
I'm just that good.
One of those rare,
you're
talents.
You're the philosopher king of acting, really.
I'm a directorless talent.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You mean rudderless or directorless?
Both, sir. Okay. I've always been rudderless.
But, you know, like, there are those great
moments. So you listen to what your enemy has to say about you. Your thinking.
In the same way that, just as you know in MMA, that your opponent is going to find your holes.
I've gained a lot of, a lot of my friends, they get criticism on Twitter and they block the person. I never blocked anybody in my life.
No.
Never in my life. Because I get some stuff from people. When people say stuff, I listen to it. Even if it's some guy, and there's usually a little truth to it. I've gained a lot from 100%. Criticism on the web.
And I'm sure that
I'm not afraid of it at all.
And I'm sure you've had fights with family members or girlfriends or your, you know.
Girlfriends, for sure.
Yeah. Where they say things about you and, like, they find your own blind spot. They find that log in your eye. And then you're like, oh.
Well, a girlfriend of mine wrote a short film. She sent it to me, and the guy in the film was me 7-8 years ago.
Yeah,
and how I used to talk to her, and I called her up and I said, "I'm so fucking sorry. I was awful."
Yeah,
and I was trying to be helpful.
Yeah,
and what a condescending fixer I was. Ugh.
But that's such a great way to see the holes and the problem in your game.
I was a young guy full of ideas.
Yep. Now, but Brian, again, let's imagine there's another cultural trait, right? Because we're swapping out the engine of our culture. If everybody embraced that idea that other people are better at seeing my fault, the faults in my thinking than I am, and we all were like, okay, this person has said something, I don't fully understand what they're talking about, but I'm going to go and try and fix it, right? How much better would we be? So, for example, my Uncle Bill, right? There's been this DNC email link. Right. And, you know, I don't like the way that the DNC ran their primary process. They excluded Larry Lessig. I think that's a huge problem. And, you know, so I've said things about that and all that sort of stuff. So it's not that I'm some, you know, blind Democrat. But that's sort of the domestic issue. The much larger problem is that it is in Vladimir Putin's interest to have a figure like Trump in power in the United States, who fundamentally will weaken NATO and weaken all of these forces that would oppose Russia's push eastward.
That's right.
Right. Now, I've talked to my Uncle Bill about this. Now, Uncle Bill has admitted publicly on Facebook that he knows nothing about Russia. I studied Russian for 2 years. I worked there. I've read everything I can about Putin and all that sort of stuff. And I know that Vladimir Putin is a dangerous man.
Yeah.
And that he's an ex-KGB agent, and he knows how to manipulate geopolitics and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know if you remember, do you remember Grizzly Man, the documentary?
Uh-huh.
Right? So, a person who doesn't know how bears work and then just sort of frolics around them and like is unconcerned about them and even slaps them across the face is dangerous.
Yes.
My Uncle Bill is Grizzly Man because he does not take the Russian bear seriously.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a great, great metaphor.
So the point is that, you know, what Uncle Bill and all of us should do, and it's emotionally difficult for all of us, is that when somebody is like, you don't understand this thing, there's a big hole in your thinking, that you go, oh shit.
Yeah.
There's something there. And it's important to recognize that when somebody points that stuff out to you, like, you know, I'm sure that whatever this girlfriend pointed out in this film, that other people had tried to point that out to you before.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
But it takes a while to understand what that thing is.
Including her.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it takes, specifically, this is where Kahneman becomes
important. So listen
important.
To what your enemies say about you.
Because what they're pointing out is how you can improve.
Barack Obama said, one of the reasons I voted for him, actually, mm-hmm. and I'm way more conservative, typically, at least libertarian, whatever that means. But I voted for him because he said, when I hear somebody I disagree with, I listen twice as closely.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. I'm going to start saying that even though it's not true. Ladies and gentlemen, I got to get on a plane and go to Phoenix, but that's been 54 minutes of 55 exactly.
Jesus, Brian. Was that intentional?
Heavy duty shit. God bless you all. And
God bless the Meiji Restoration.
Yes. The Meiji! Meiji!
Meiji!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.